Welcome to Decoding the Customer. I'm your host, Julia Allfelt. Disruption is everywhere, and established industries such as financial services are scrambling to understand how they can keep up. I recently spoke with Roger Norton about fintech innovation and market disruption in the banking sector. Roger is the CEO of PlayLogix, a startup studio based in Cape Town, South Africa. He's passionate about technology and its potential to change Africa, and he focuses on startups as a vehicle for innovation. At PlayLogix, he's built over 40 tech products in 4 years. He's also the author of Start Here, a guide for startup entrepreneurs, and the co-founder of the Lean Iterator, a business model validation process to help both entrepreneurs and investors make better decisions. Roger's perspective isn't limited to fledgling businesses. He has also collaborated with some of South Africa's largest banks as they have evaluated and launched strategies to improve their participation in fintech innovation. During our conversation, we referenced several South African consumer banking brands, including Absa, Standard Bank, FNB, and Nedbank. While these may not be household names for those listening in other locations, the composition of the South African banking sector is pretty similar to what you would find elsewhere. The industry is dominated by a handful of major institutions that have been around for decades, if not longer. For these institutions, as with global banking giants such as HSBC, Citibank, JPMorgan Chase, and others, disruption from fintech is real, and they're battling to understand how they can remain relevant amid a world that is constantly changing around them. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Roger. I hope that you enjoy it. Roger, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. It's wonderful to get the perspective of someone who's been involved with innovation through the tech startup world and as an advisor to some of South Africa's largest financial companies. Maybe we could start out by talking about disruption. I know that that's a buzzword at the moment. It's something that's really top of mind for a lot of companies. Why don't you give us your definition of disruption?
Sure. Hi, Julia. Yeah, disruption is one of those words that's right up there with innovation, and that it's so overused that it becomes so meaningless in what you actually are trying to do. And for us, disruption is, if you're looking at a value stream, it's about removing or reordering steps in that value stream, and that's disrupting the way that value moves through the system. And so if you're looking at innovation as a form of disruption, you can do that either iteratively or innovatively with a large change or a small increment on what you've got, but it's really about identifying it from the customer's perspective. How does value move through that system, and how do you deliver that more effectively? Like Uber removing the payment step from taxis. Mm-hmm. That is a disruption in that you don't pay for cabs anymore. You just get out and the money disappears. But it was a huge disruption in how they work and how the business runs. So it's about identifying what those steps are in the value stream and then either removing them or reordering it. So having you call a cab before you go outside instead of going outside and then calling the cab. We look at disruption through a value stream model of seeing who are the players in the system and how does that value move and how can we change the way value is extracted or delivered through that.
Mm-hmm. And when you're looking at that, are you looking at sort of how and what consumers may value differently, and then where there's opportunity to disrupt that?
Yeah, so we fall quite heavily on the lean startup space of looking at using lean startup principles and how to innovate. But a lot of the times it actually starts with the customer development space, which overlaps a bit more with design thinking, where you need to go out and observe and understand and really identify the core needs of the customer and understand how the business is fulfilling those needs before you can actually look at ways of stripping out those value streams or switching them up or replacing versus looking at different unmet needs of the customer and how you might be able to innovate against that. But it really comes down to building something people want and making sure that it's relevant to the end customer. It doesn't help to innovate for innovation's sake.
So do you think that the core needs of customers have changed, or do you think that organizations are just having to do a better job of listening to those needs, or is it a little bit of both?
I think the world is always changing, and the world in which the customer is always changing. And that dynamic, the way they want to interact, the way they use their phones, the way they engage, the type of service they expect is completely dynamic. And so if the business isn't understanding and putting the customer at the center around how they're delivering what they're delivering, there's no way of measuring whether that's actually relevant or effective or not. So for us, even on the innovation space, it's all around looking at customers. And for us, customers are sort of a better term is a stakeholder. So it might be internal customers. It might be internal processes and how people are doing stuff. And how do they think about delivering value within their organization as much as how do they deliver the value to the people who ultimately pay them. And when you're looking at the different stakeholders as customer segments and understanding the dynamics between them, you can start mapping how solutions fix those customers' needs and achieve the jobs to be done of those customers and how you can do that more effectively.
And do you think that over the last, I don't know, 5, 10, maybe even 15 years, the wants and needs of those different stakeholder groups, have they changed dramatically? And
massively, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everyone's complaining about millennials and they don't know how to service or deal with millennials. And that's just a symptom of their customer changing and them not changing fast enough to actually understand what those new needs are. What are the new wants of those customers and what are the jobs that they're doing to fulfill on those wants? And until you understand that the business is always in flux and that your customers are evolving. And as new people come into the ecosystem and new customer segments come out, you need to be continually understanding that. And if you're not tracking it and analyzing it, you're never going to pick up the shift.
If you were to call out, you know, 2 or 3 sort of key differences in terms of millennials' wants and needs, what would those be?
They're wanting a lot more. It's called instant gratification by our generation. But in reality, for them, it's about fulfillment. It's about doing something meaningful and understanding the meaning of why they're doing things. And quite often, the status quo or the way things used to be, it's done because that's how it's always been done, not because that's the most useful or the most meaningful. And so when you're looking at that, you can understand how, like, millennials want things on demand. They want things to be easy because they want added value, not just the way it was done before. They've come from a big disillusionment around housing and marriage and kids, and there's a huge shift in how they live their lives and what is valuable to them. And I would say that shift is around meaning now, not meaning when I retire. It's how do I get value now? How do I get meaning now? And how are businesses engaging with me in such a way as to provide that value for me as and when I need it, not waiting 3 hours to a call center to actually get your question answered. How do I get that through an app? How do I get that through websites? How do I get that value faster and more relevant?
That's interesting. So that's almost like delivering on the brand promise immediately instead of in some undefined future.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of old systems, people were willing to wait. We still are from the generation where we had dial-up phones and landlines, whereas the modern generation doesn't have that. They're used to getting the app notification. They're used to doing their banking or checking out their bank account or their social media or what's happening at 12 o'clock at night. And so a business can no longer be constrained to, oh, we can only deal with you on our terms, but you've got to actually meet millennials on their terms. And that's been a big shift from our generation or the generation before us around how companies need to adapt for that. And it's about meeting them where they're at.
So given that we've got this new up-and-coming segment of customers with different wants and needs, do you think that the South African financial services industry, specifically, I know that's an area of major focus for your work, do you think that industry is ripe for disruption?
Absolutely. And part of the reason is because banks aren't particularly innovative. And the way the system is designed, they're not supposed to be innovative. I don't want the average person at the bank to try and disrupt and change things and break things because it's my money and they need to look after my money.
There has to be an element of stability.
There has to be a huge, and it's a large element of stability in banks. But at the same time, these organizations are so slow in moving and their architecture and their structures are so slow that it leaves huge opportunities for people who can find solutions to deliver in a more immediate, more instant gratification way, to avoid people having to go into the banks, into the branches, to make access to capital more customizable for my needs instead of just speak through a broker and he'll sell me the ones that only he can see. Or engaging with real-time banking or seeing your transactions come up fast enough. And a lot of the banks, their structures and institutions and their cultures have been around regulation and stability for so long that as technology increases and as the world starts moving faster, they actually really struggle to keep up. And a number of the banks that we've been engaging with are looking at more and more, how does the bank focus on being an infrastructure play? How do they be the plumbing that actually can empower solutions to move faster instead of them trying to own the entire chain, the entire customer experience from start to finish? And so, I mean, a number of the banks are approaching this in slightly different ways. Someone like FNB is actually taking a completely internal approach. So they've re-architected their APIs and their structures, and they run internal hackathons and they run internal teams around how can they help their staff come up with better ideas and create a more flexible company structure to be able to innovate and to be able to change and be able to move faster. Whereas other banks like Barclays is completely outsourcing that. So they're working with things like the Barclays Techstars program or a number of external partners where they're looking at running programs or finding innovation that is happening out there and then bringing it into the bank and finding a way to run proof of concepts or pilots or doing some kind of partnership deal or selling it on just being the access to empower those businesses into their markets and potentially taking a stake in them or with a late idea of acquisition down the line. But it's more they're trying to externally find the innovation and then sink that into the bank. A Standard Bank is going about halfway between the two. So they're looking at open innovation platforms where they're trying to find ways that they can become innovative internally while doing a bit of restructuring and becoming more customer focused in their processes, but at the same time looking at keeping an eye open for external things that they can innovate in or external products they can build, like the SnapScan or Shift that we recently built for them, around how can they keep doing what they're doing as the core bank, but in the gaps where they can't move fast enough, then working with outside partners for that. So each of these banks have a slightly different strategy, and it's too early to say which one's going to be better, but they're all realizing that something needs to change. And it's down to willingness and time that'll actually show you which one's successful.
So while it's too early to tell which one has been successful, do you have a sense of which of these approaches is yielding better initial results? Can you say?
Yeah, so Barclays has probably had the most successful progress, but it's probably the least meaningful to their core business. And they're looking at also launching a set of APIs that are the internal banking APIs as well as many other open systems as they can, that they can plug into to really say, oh, if you want to, here's an API to get loans, you can make the request to Absa and get the Barclays loan and the value on that, or here's Wongo, and they're offering competing services alongside their own banking services. So they make a lot of splash and a lot of noise, but I don't know how fundamental that's actually improving for their customers and for their core banking systems.
So you were just referencing there too, that's a model that sounds a bit more like this Barclays being kind of the plumbing model. And then Wonga is a third party provider of loans. Absa is one of the big banks here in South Africa. So those companies would be the ones providing the loans, but Barclays would be the one supporting the kind of underlying plumbing for that. That's the idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I think FNB is gone the similar route. They just haven't opened it up yet. FNB actually re-architected their, they went on a program started about two years ago, where they actually rebuilt their entire core banking systems to work through disconnected APIs and through a certain structure. And they're currently doing internal innovation on top of that. But if they ever needed to, they could actually open that up to other third parties and that would leapfrog them ahead. So I think they've taken a slightly longer view to build a better foundation of which they can build later. Whether they actually eventually do that or whether they do that in time to stay relevant or thing is, yeah, up to the, we'll see how that pans out.
Okay.
But yeah, it's still quite early to say. Like there's been a little bit of successes, and you could say that with Standard Bank, SnapScan and sort of Shift have been good examples of them doing arm's length innovation that's completely powered and owned by the bank.
And SnapScan is an app that allows users to take a photo of a QR code that's on a restaurant receipt, for example, and then pay instantly with their phone rather than having to use the credit card machine or bring cash.
Very, very similar to a WeChat wallet. And it's designed to, so SnapScan plays in the space where for small merchants, credit card fees are quite considerable. Mm-hmm. So if you're paying $1,500 or $150 a month to have the credit card facility, and you're paying 3 to 3.5% commission on that, that's quite high. Where SnapScan has zero upfront fee and a 2.8%, I think it started 3 or 2.8% when you withdraw the cash. So it's a very low barrier of entry. If they don't use it, it doesn't cost them anything. And so they're kind of innovating around that space where there's a physical infrastructure problem because it's a monopoly of Visa and MasterCard on what those charges are and what those fees are. And so they've innovated a way around that.
That's interesting because in that example, there's added value both for the end consumer in terms of ease of use, and then there's also added value for the enterprise level customer in terms of lower prices for...
Yeah, absolutely. And what happens with these smaller merchants is, I mean, Visa and MasterCard's percentage could be anything between 1.8 and 3.2 or 3.4% that they take. And if you're a small vendor, it's towards the upper end. But with SnapScan, the way they aggregate, if they're doing all those credit card transactions through their system, they can push closer to the 1.8%.
Okay.
So by actually pulling together, creating solutions for smaller businesses, you can aggregate that to act as a bigger business and get better rates in the actual transaction volumes.
Okay. Earlier, you used a term called disconnected API. What does that mean for anybody out there who is unfamiliar with that?
So modern software architecture is moving away from what they call monolithic apps, which is where the front end and the back end and all your service layer is built as one massive spaghetti bowl. And that's really hard to innovate and change and things. So what they're looking at now is a much more modular architecture where your database layer is wrapped by a service layer with a set of APIs. And an API is an automatic programmable interface. It's a standard on how computer systems can talk to each other. So a computer system will say, these are the things you can ask me. This is how you ask me. And these are the responses in the format I'm going to give you back. And so that standardizes the way that different modules or different parts of the computer system can actually talk to each other. And what that enables for you is you can build small pieces and you can build and test them and run them in parallel. You can spin up two or three versions of the same thing wherever the bottleneck is in your software, or you can innovate and replace just one module. And because it still talks through the APIs in the same way to everything else, you're not breaking the entire system with that. So it allows you to evolve and use different bits without the whole thing being tied together into one mess.
It sounds a bit like perhaps the app development and tech world has created a more dynamic answer to how they develop solutions for customers. Because if you're having to be agile and quickly, you have to find a way to do that that is agile and quick.
Yeah, absolutely. And a way you can see that is instead of a customer needing a digital bank account or some kind of APIs for that, instead of needing the entire banking facilities and all the credit and payments and electricity and airtime and everything else they offer, like, for example, Standard Bank now offers a product called Root on root.co.za, which is a programmable bank account. It literally just puts money in and puts money out and records the balances. And you can order a physical card that's linked to that wallet. So it's about breaking down those little services so that you could build a solution that just needs a wallet or just needs a loan facility or just needs some kind of insurance or just needs credit facilities without needing to take everything together. So your solutions are a lot more tailored, a lot more optimized, and you're not trying to bloat the system with unnecessary things that don't actually fulfill the needs of your customers.
Okay. So staying on this topic of, you know, sort of the innovations that are happening, we've seen companies like Airbnb and Uber and Amazon really disrupt the established structure of their markets. Do you think that there will be a fintech disruptor of this same scale?
Whether there'll be one disruptor, I don't quite know. I think fundamentally, Bitcoin and the rise of cryptocurrencies will change the financial industry far more than any individual company or individual solution. The concept of how you can build an entire business and raise funding through an ICO, initial coin offering, and effectively the company can be a non-profit. You raise the funding through an ICO, you reward your shareholders and the staff through a cryptocurrency that you own that powers your solution and that runs in a decentralized way, and you can actually be running a multi-$100 million non-profit business and actually everyone's still getting reimbursed in the same way. And because it's a token-based cryptocurrency, you have complete liquidity. So early investors can swap out and you can actually redeem the money more faster. So I don't know, that's a technical rabbit hole that we're going down, but the potential of how that will change our financial systems is so significant that we actually have no idea how extreme that will actually be.
So because something like that circumvents the traditional system entirely, it also circumvents Federal Reserve banks, and that creates its whole other can of worms. Yeah, maybe we should save for another.
Totally. But if you're looking at smaller innovations, I mean, you have things like lemonade, or you have
what's that?
Lemonade is
besides a delicious drink that one enjoys on a hot summer day.
Absolutely, yeah. Lemonade is a way for you to invest smaller amounts, and then it decides where you should put the money according to your risk profile. Mm-hmm. So it's an investment mechanism that is the lowest possible barrier to entry to just get people in and get people saving something. And as you start saving more and as it starts learning more about you, it starts diversifying your portfolio and managing that portfolio for you. And that is completely arm's length from a bank. With the power of services like Yodlee, or there's another one called, I think it's MLC, that allows you to scrape bank accounts and then actually pull your bank account data in. Now any app like a 22/7 or a mint.com can start offering you financial services or financial advice or upselling that or giving you analytics that your bank hasn't even been able to do by scraping the data from the bank. So
it sort of aggregates that and brings it all together so that a user can see, you know, their whole financial picture in a consolidated way.
Absolutely. Well, it's about finding the value that the banks aren't delivering and delivering solutions for that. So a lot of the banks, like, I don't understand why my bank, like, why isn't the bank interface a basic budgeting tool? And that's a huge need, that they've got all the data, they know all my spending habits, they know my entire financial history, but they give me nothing more than here's the list of transactions that you have. Okay. And that's where the space for new things coming out. You're looking at other solutions like a Revolut, which is a card that you can get. You download the app and they'll ship a card anywhere in the world. It's a multi-currency card and you can hot swap to dollars or pounds or euros from that. Very similar to what we built for Standard Bank actually in the Shift app, which is, you never need to go into a bank branch. You just download an app. You can order the card from that. You can load money in and spend and transact with that.
So. Okay. So do you think that all of this is sort of a chronicle of a death foretold for the big banks, or will they be able to keep up?
I don't think they're going to be able to keep up. Their structures and their systems are not designed to be nimble enough and to be able to change to this at the rate that the world is changing. But having said that, I think the real value for them will come in is, I mean, ultimately a bank's job is to hold your money and issue credit. Mm-hmm. Everything else they do is fluff. And that's why
and
a lot
fluff
of
that they might not necessarily be very good at.
Yeah, absolutely. I have some strong feelings about that we don't need to go into. But if you look at the core value that a bank does, is it holds your money in a secure place. It allows you to extract and use that money through cards or through transfers, and it issues you credit when you need that. And and if the banks focus purely on that and look at empowering other solutions like the next Uber or Airbnb or Revolut or Lemonade or one of those who can better solve niche solutions and in a more dynamic way for the customer, the more the institutions are looking at empowering those businesses, the more relevant they're going to be in the future. The more they try and be those competitors, they're going to completely get, they just can't move fast enough, so they're going to get killed. So that's kind of my take. They should be looking is cutting down to what their core systems are and leveraging better technology and services to empower those solutions instead of trying to compete on the customer level.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that there may always be a need or a demand for the plumbing that the banks provide, and that they should focus on that and open things up so that there's opportunity for others to provide better experiences and be more agile around that, but that they should focus on sort of their wheelhouse, which is the plumbing.
Yeah, there's a couple of core things that people always need. You'll always need food, you'll always need clothes, you'll always need somewhere to store your money that's safe and secure and hopefully making you some kind of interest. Like, focusing on those fundamental needs will always be relevant. And it's very difficult for a small player to actually be able to provide that kind of infrastructure and governance and Reserve Bank approval and then the complexity around that. It's designed to be really, really difficult to be a bank. Mm-hmm. So if the bank focuses on the assets that it has and the value that it can provide, they could streamline and cut their costs quite significantly by scaling back on the customer interactions and looking at more about fulfilling the fundamental needs. Mm-hmm. The complete caveat to that is if we move to cryptocurrencies, it might undermine the entire financial system.
Exactly.
But that's an existential crisis that we're still quite far away from that. And by far, I mean 5 to 10 years from us actually being able to articulate why and how that will really happen. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of speculation at the moment. But for the next 5 to 10 years, if a bank focused on the fundamental value it's delivering and how it can do that better and more efficiently, I think it's going to be a winning strategy.
Great. So the examples that you mentioned, the local examples here from the South African market, are those organizations following global trends? Are there lessons that we can leverage from other markets?
There's a certain amount you can learn from other markets. It's very risky game to try and just take what's working elsewhere and roll it out here, because a lot of the consumers are different, the markets are different. So you need to understand the nuances of how the markets are different. And I mean, we build quite a lot of startups, and as well as doing some of the corporate R&D side. And the one thing with the startups is they're built around insight, and they're built around an understanding that nobody else has.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, it's very difficult to copy someone and gain their understanding of why they do things. You can see what they do and how they do it, but you don't really have that insight as to why they do that and why that actually works. And until you can articulate that why, it's very dangerous just to blindly copy, because you need to understand the why in their market, the why in your market, and then customize the solution to better solve that fundamental customer's want or the need and what it is in that market. And if you're just trying to copy for the sake of copying because it works somewhere else, there's plenty of examples from Rocket Internet or WeChat to show that it's very, very difficult to do if you don't fundamentally understand that market.
I see that happen in the customer experience field all the time, is theories and global best practices. You have to be very careful not to take those as cut and paste solutions, that actually those things, when you move them from one context to another, it requires quite a bit of customization, and you have to look at the context of
the situation. It's the culture and the environment, and how, and mobile money is another great example of this, that it works in certain circumstances for certain reasons, and it's not hot swappable.
Yeah. What are some of the common pitfalls, hurdles, challenges that you see with the big organizations that are looking at becoming more innovative, integrating an innovation function, or perhaps taking this sort of outsourced approach? What are the challenges that you
see? So large organizations have a fundamental issue, in my opinion, and that's that they are completely designed and optimized, and all their systems and their processes and their structures are there to minimize risk. So their hierarchies, their legal departments, the branding, everything is there to ensure that the business is to minimize risk. They're happy to pay a premium for services if it'll minimize their risk. But the problem is innovation requires doing new things. And that, by definition, means trying things that are going to fail. And it's a lot of the corporates, their culture, their people, their structures, the way they think and work and measure success is done on a risk reduction basis. And innovation is always difficult when that's your focus.
Almost like an oil and water situation.
Absolutely. And there's plenty of ways that you can make it work. But without acknowledging that that fundamental inertia and structure and cultures and hierarchy and ways of things being sold in, like a lot of innovation programs ultimately get killed or squashed before they have any kind of any real tangible value to the core business, because as it starts gaining momentum, the immune system and the systems within the organization repel that and will undermine it and try and kill it. Not intentionally, but that's how the systems are designed. And that's how our corporates are run. That's what keeps them alive, is to do that. And that's great for staying alive in the short term, but not for the long term. And it's being able to hold the space and keep the two beasts at bay, mm-hmm. around culture and process and understanding and measurement and remuneration and every aspect of that. If you're wanting to do innovation, you can, but you need to understand that dichotomy and how to actually design a system to more effectively, mm-hmm. interface with that.
That's a great way to think about it, as an immune system. So, you know, the organization sees an invader, sees something that's different and wants to attack and repel. That's great.
And there's a lot of correlations between the human body and certain organizations and how we've sort of structured that. And the parts in the body that don't know why they do something, it's just that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And it has this much greater effect that even the white blood cells or red blood cells don't fully comprehend, but that is what they do. And that's how the system works. And until you can design a different structure and systems within that and acknowledge those systems, you're never going to be able to change
them. Do you see organizations being able to sort of evolve and change their immune system so that it doesn't repel innovation? And what steps are those organizations taking?
Oh, there's the big question. Yeah, I don't have a silver bullet for this. If I did, I would probably be retired by now.
Yeah.
But
probably isn't a single.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There is no single silver bullet. It's going to depend on the ecosystem. It's going to depend on the culture of the company. It's going to depend what you need to change, what needs are you doing, how your market, how quickly your competitors are responding. For me, the first step to successfully being able to do it is to acknowledge it. And once you acknowledge it, you can analyze it and then design a better system that'll help you achieve an end. And also a lot of companies, like, are you designing for the to dominate a market? Are you designing to be the most innovative? Are you designing, like, what are you trying to optimize for? There's a huge misconception, for example, in lean, like the lean startup is around just bootstrapping and doing stuff. And it's actually not. It's around optimizing a system. So you optimize for rate of learning, whereas a larger corporate optimizes for minimum of risk. And so until you create a new optimization goal and you reflect across all your systems and cultures and things to do that, that you can design those to optimize for your new goal, it's going to be very difficult to do. It's not impossible, but that's often why it's easier to innovate by doing something at arm's length or spinning out a much larger team and then actually having that compete with the larger corporate. But even that, there's a lot of tension in how they do that, and having a new business cannibalize an old business.
Yeah.
Amazon actually has a really great model around innovating within structures. So what they do is each of their divisions or each of their products, they have a rule that a certain percentage of it, it's 20 or 30% of that division's revenue has to come from outside Amazon. And so what that forces them to do is it forces them to be competitive in the market at warehousing or at distribution or at IT infrastructure. Like, loads of people run on AWS. And what that does is they're suddenly competing.
AWS is Amazon.
Amazon Web Services, mm-hmm. their cloud hosting service. And they're suddenly competing on all those levels. So they need to keep innovating. They need to be some of the best in the market. And it's a lot easier to do that when you have a massive customer like Amazon who, if you can show that you're able to compete in the market, they will keep using your products. And that gives you a huge revenue stream and sort of guarantee that you can innovate on top of and keep ahead of the market. But by breaking the company up into these smaller things that need to each compete and each be successful companies in their own right, Amazon as a whole has efficiencies that nobody else can match because they don't have large systems and top-down structures and divisions that are non-profitable. It needs to be optimized, it needs to be competitive, it needs to be profitable. And with that structure, they've actually managed to change the entire innovation structure and how the company actually runs on a fundamental company structure level. Mm-hmm. So it certainly is possible to do. I don't think it's easy, and I have a lot of respect for Amazon and Jeff Bezos and in how he's managed to achieve that. But there are examples of companies that have, large companies that have fundamentally reinvented themselves and are designed themselves for innovation to stay relevant and keep relevant in the future. But a lot of companies, like majority of companies, will really, really struggle with that.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like doing that could also create an element of conflict if you've got what sort of end up becoming two competing businesses within an organization, how that can become conflicting. And I could see something like that happening where, you know, a larger bank maybe acquires a smaller startup and then says, hey, wait a minute, some of these things that this startup is doing are functions that we've done before. So we'll just absorb that. And then it no longer becomes a part of the startup and it loses that.
Well, as soon as the company buys it, they say, okay, well, now you're part of our company. Okay, now we need this risk and compliance and we need this reporting and we need this layers of approval and authority. And what they're doing is they're taking all of their risk mitigating structures and applying it and suffocating this thing that has been designed for optimization of or rapid learning or designing around a customer. And as soon as you add that weight of those risk mitigation structures, it just completely suffocates that product. And
the immune system at work.
The immune system at work, absolutely. Like, there's a foreign object that's come in,
yeah.
And it needs to actually do that unless you can define how they play and create the right space and tension in that. And one of the biggest problems for this tension, you talk about the tension with innovation and normal business versus new product, is a lot of new products. I mean, if you look at a venture capitalist, they take a 5 to 10 year view of when they're going to get their funding back. They're not in it for short-term goings. They make a wide set of investments and they sit on them for 5 to 10 years before they're actually measuring what kind of returns they get when those funds close. Whereas if you look at corporate CEOs, they're measured on quarterly or even annual basis is a very short term to try and measure structural innovation because it just doesn't happen that fast. When you're trying to build new things and you're trying to go out, the remuneration and measurement needs to be different. And so quite often a new business, if you're onto something, as soon as it starts competing and pulling the short-term revenues away from the old systems, they get this huge tension because they're not incentivized to win in 10 to 15 years' time to make sure that the bank will always be relevant because the CEO is not going to be there anymore or the upper management isn't or whoever's in charge of that division would have probably moved on by then in these 2 to 3 year cycles that they're sort of moved through. And the way that the shareholders are measuring the success of a CEO is disconnected from that. And innovation, you need to take a longer term view. You need to think like a venture capital and to invest in startups. And that's a model that we've put together on how they can do this, is sort of creating a box in the larger corporate and treat these ideas and innovations as if they were startups. Give them the sort of bootstrap funding they need to get them through, hold them to venture capital standards with a 5 to 7 year return, instead of trying to measure how that actually delivers on a quarterly or 6 monthly or annual basis. And we've been a part of a couple of innovation programs that after the first year just get shut down and management changes at the top, or there's a political shift, or the immune system of the company is designed to just see the threat and justify why it's not good for the larger whole, and they end up killing that. And that's a huge tension that needs to be managed.
Yeah, I think stakeholder management is something that is really important and is something that's going to have to change. I mean, when you're looking at return on investment for customer centricity efforts, for example, it's a much longer time horizon. So you're not going to improve customer retention in a quarter.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're going to see results in 12 or 18 months. And yet leaders of established corporates look at that and say, right, well, I have to, you know, respond to the market and to my shareholders, and I have to release my quarterly reports, and I'm going to be judged on this, and the organization is going to be judged on this. So until the business community really makes that shift, it's going to be an uphill battle for sure.
Absolutely. And then there's people like Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger who do take the long view. They do invest for the long term. Like, some of the best investors are thinking like that, but they're certainly the minority. And the majority of sort of Wall Street or investment bankers are looking for their next quarterly kickback. They're looking for, how can we do this quick structure that'll make it look really, really good in the short term, but in the longer term is going to cause a financial crisis when the whole house of cards finally collapses. And the good investors do already think like that. It's just, there's so much noise in the short term, and markets and commentators and news is all focused around those inconsequential things. I mean, Nicholas Taleb would go his whole black swan thing. Is that you need to be trying to identify the 15 to 20 year things that'll fundamentally shift or kill your business. And that's what you should be optimizing for and investing against. Lose money every day for 15 years. But when that one event happens and you're the one who's prepared, you'll make more money than everybody else has in that short term. And that's the kind of thinking that needs to be structured around innovation. It's around doing new things. It's a different mindset and culture to normal.
I heard somebody refer to this the other day as patient capital, which I thought was a cool concept. Is this long-term time horizon view on investment. That was kind of a cool concept.
Patient capital, that's an interesting term.
Patient as in patience, not patient as in patient in a hospital.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's one thing to be patient, but it's another to manage risk. And there's a fine balance there as well, in that certain people are positioned correctly to be able to be more patient by the breakdown of their portfolio or their lifestyles or what they're needing out of that. But a lot of people actually do need those short-term wins, and they're structured and focused around that. So patient capital is much better. I mean, when you look at startups, it's like an investor that's trying to push to get his money out, or trying to often overextends the startup and they burn out. It significantly increases their chance of failure when they're getting pushed too hard. But for the investor, he's invested in 10 of these businesses. He only needs one to succeed. So he's going to push them all as hard as possible, let the 9 die and make all his money back on the 1. So patient capital is a double-edged sword as well. Okay. It's not to say that everyone should just invest and let it go. You need to understand why you're investing and what the factors are around that.
Great. So any parting words of wisdom or advice for either a startup organization that is looking to launch a product into an established market, or for one of these big businesses that is looking to integrate innovation into what they do?
Probably the most prudent advice I give to most startups and what we look for in corporates is to do less. Focus more and do less. And if you can identify one or two core needs and one or two core features that you can deliver for that, that's infinitely better than trying to identify 20 needs that aren't prioritized properly and trying to build this bloated system that throws out a whole bunch of features, because all that does is it increases the signal to noise ratio. It increases the amount of noise, and you lose the real feedback and understanding from your customers of what's actually relevant. And that other bloat is a complete distraction from the core value that you're delivering, the two or three fundamental things that you're delivering for the customer. And actually, by cutting and doing less, you can deliver a far better experience, far more focused, and respond to feedback and change more quickly, which will help you stay more relevant. And as soon as you try and build these massive spaghetti ball systems, it's very difficult to be innovative. And that's, I mean, take it from the coding of building these modular structures. How do you design a company that is done in a modular way, that it's easy for you to drop a feature, remove it, or hot swap it, or only offer it in certain circumstances to a certain subset of users? And you just can't do that if you're trying to be everything to everyone. You need to identify what those segments are, identify what those needs are, and deliver the one or two fundamental needs that actually solves that. And it's much easier to build a great product that is super simple than a great product that's very complex.
Okay, that's interesting. So back to the theme of being dynamic and agile around changing consumer needs. In terms of, you know, for the large organizations, would you have any words of wisdom if they're evaluating a potential innovation function or sponsoring outside innovation that they could potentially bring in-house?
It starts with just understanding the tensions that are going to exist and acknowledging those upfront so that you can build systems that will help to mitigate those. And you need to design a set of red flags or systems that you can understand when those, that immune system, because it'll try and kill you in so many different ways. Unless you're really clear that that's going to happen and you're aware of that and you're watching for it, it's going to be very difficult on how you build your processes or your systems. And to be honest, there's plenty of innovation processes out there. They're very similar between design thinking or lean startup or Vanguard or customer development, or there's so much overlap in what they're doing. There's very few right or wrong ways of doing it. It's more about understanding the context and picking the right tools out of the toolbox that work in your market, in your need, within your constraints. And so whether it might be a bit of design thinking, it might be a bit of customer development, and it's understanding what those tools are and then designing the relevant system that works for you in your market that fulfills the business needs that you're trying to achieve. And at the same time, putting a box around it or designing the interface between this new division, the new business and the old business. And how do you, they call it mode one and mode two, if you want to go with Gartner. It's this acknowledging that and defining that and drawing those lines and having managed engagement between the two different sections and understanding that and setting that up from the beginning is going to be crucial to the success. It's like, go out and try stuff totally, but do it within the right context. And okay, you need to first set that context and that environment. And that, way more importantly than which design methodology you choose to use.
Interesting. Well, fabulous words of wisdom. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's been great to speak with you.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot for coming by.
Thank you for listening to my conversation with Roger Norton. For more information, please visit my website, julia-allfelt.com, where you can find show notes from this episode and sign up to be notified when new episodes go live.